The Wall Street Journal gets yoga right, but Baptists wrong. Why China fears Christians. The last Episcopal holdout gives out. Freedom of religious speech in Los Angeles. Rethinking the culture of poverty. The perpetual French Revolution. And how many ways can you say, I'm sorry? All that, and the fifth anniversary of Truthiness. It's Friday, October 22, 2010. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. In today's edition of The Wall Street Journal, Stephen Prothero of Boston University writes with an article asking the question, can yoga be Christian? Now, he suggests that, as I have made the argument that yoga is not for Christians, that I am onto something, and yet he also takes me to task. I read from his article, he says this, Christian yogis, according to Mr. Mohler, must either deny the reality of what yoga represents or fail to see the contradictions between their Christian commitments and their embrace of yoga. As he later told the Associated Press, the idea that the body is a vehicle for reaching consciousness with the divine, that's just not Christianity. Then, Mr. Prothero writes, in other words, man up and choose. You can't have your Savior and your son's salvation, too. He goes on in his article to at least acknowledge that my position on yoga, as articulated in an article I wrote back in September, is actually something of a mainstream Christian position. In fact, it's almost the unanimous Christian tradition until at least very recently. He then goes on, and speaking of my argument, writes, perhaps unintentionally, Mr. Mohler's statements largely echo what Hindu thinkers have long said about the Americanization of yoga. When I discuss the ongoing yoga craze with Hindus, they do not object to their venerable tradition being twisted toward sometimes banal ends. They ask only for practitioners to acknowledge that yoga emerged in ancient India and that its original intent was spiritual, a path to liberation rather than weight loss. Yoga cannot be neatly separated into physical and spiritual dimensions, Mr. Mohler has said. The physical is the spiritual in yoga, and the exercises and disciplines of yoga are meant to connect with the divine. Now, this is where he agrees with me and takes me to task. In today's Wall Street Journal, he says, Mr. Mohler does American Christians a favor by encouraging them to think more deeply about where the traditions of Christianity and the practice of yoga diverge. But he missteps when he insists that, quote, Christians are not called to see the human body as a means of connecting to and coming to know the divine, end quote. Now, it's at this point that Stephen Prothero's article gets really interesting. After all, he is the great advocate of religious literacy, and he's acknowledged as one of the great scholars of religion in America today. But what he writes next, well, just listen to it for yourselves. He says this, Catholics, of course, have long seen the seven sacraments, including baptism, Eucharist, and others, all of which by definition operate on the body as vehicles of grace. And Protestants, including Mr. Mohler's Southern Baptist denomination, have typically affirmed the sacramental nature of baptism and Holy Communion. There is no bending or twisting in these rites, but in both Protestants traditionally see the human body as a means of connecting oneself to the divine. End quote. Well, Professor Prothero, that's where your argument goes off the rails, because it is not the case that Southern Baptists affirm the sacramental character of the ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper. This is a profound issue of disagreement and divergence between Baptists and many other Protestants. So, if the article comes down to the fact that our sacramentalism is actually not so much in conflict with the body as a means of revelation, and thus we need to get over the concern about the body as it relates to yoga, the argument breaks down at least for Baptists and other evangelicals who reject the actual sacramental character of the Lord's Supper and baptism. Historically, Baptists have seen baptism and the Lord's Supper as ordinances, as actions of obedience commanded by Christ, teaching ordinances for the church, but not as actual means of grace or sacraments. So, we'll have to revisit that argument. Nevertheless, it's not every day you get to have a theological argument with yourself in the pages of the Wall Street Journal. So, Mr. Prothero, thank you for your article. Today's edition of the Wall Street Journal has another important article. This one comes in the form of an editorial published in the Review and Outlook edition of the Asia edition of the Wall Street Journal. In the editorial entitled China's Underground Christians, the Wall Street Journal reports that the Chinese Constitution states that citizens enjoy freedom of religious belief. But they go on to say the experience of Buddhists in Tibet, of Muslims, of members of Falun Gong, and now of many Christians Well, all this can attest to the bullying that the faithful in China must endure. Now, the source of this editorial, the prompt for this writing, is last week's event when more than 200 Chinese Christians were barred from leaving the country to attend the Luzon 3 conference. That is the third Luzon conference on world evangelization being held right now in South Africa. The journal reports the delegation represented China's house churches or unregistered private assemblies. A foreign ministry spokesman said that the conference's organizers had subverted the official Chinese church by only inviting the underground leaders, calling this, quote, a flagrant interference in China's religious affairs. The editorial goes on to state it's hard to see how this is true, given that China bans proselytizing only in public places and not in the private homes where these congregants meet. What officials more likely object to, and this is what we need to see in this article as being of supreme importance, what officials more likely object to is the church's threat to the Communist Party's authority. Now listen to these statistics. According to the Pew Research Center, 20 million Chinese Protestants and more than 5 million Catholics attend government-sanctioned services, but between 50 million and 70 million Chinese now worship in the more popular house churches. The Chinese Communist Party has only some 60 million members. So, by almost any estimation, these 70 or 50 million Chinese Christians, who are risking at least their reputations and social standing, if not their jobs and worse, by worshiping in these house churches, are actually outnumbering the members of the Chinese Communist Party. The difference is, of course, that the Communist Party holds the levers of power in government, and they have the Chinese military. But long term, it's hard not to see why the Chinese regime is so worried about all these Christians. As indeed the gospel spreads, the numbers are going to increase, and eventually, it doesn't take long before the outnumbered Communist Party is outnumbered by a significant factor beyond their wildest imagination. We should ponder the fact that the Chinese Communist regime has done its very best to eradicate and eliminate Christianity from within China's borders, going back especially to Mao's revolution and then fast-forwarding to the Cultural Revolution. Every effort was made to eradicate Christianity, to persecute Christian pastors, and there are no shortage of Chinese martyred Christians whose testimony was written in blood. But as it turns out, in the providence of God, during all those years of persecution, the Chinese church did not disappear, it simply went underground. And in going underground, it began to grow. Now we look at the growth that is reported and even acknowledged by the Chinese government, and we can see why it sees such a threat to its own authority ahead. A new hallmark was reached in recent days as the last holdout Episcopal diocese ordained its first female priest. Religion News Service reports that women have been ordained as priests in all 110 dioceses of the Episcopal Church after the last holdout in Quincy, Illinois, ordained its first woman on Saturday, October the 16th. The Reverend Margaret Lee, a grandmother of five and former chemist, is the first woman ordained as a priest in the Peoria-based Diocese of Quincy's 133-year history. A spokesman for the Episcopal Church said that this means that now all 110 dioceses in the Episcopal Church have ordained at least one female priest. That denomination voted to open the priesthood to women in 1976. The Quincy Diocese, which numbers about 1,800 members in 24 different churches, was one of three dioceses that had refused to ordain women. But its former bishop, a staunch conservative, according to RNS, retired in 2008. The other two holdout dioceses, that is the Diocese of San Joaquin, California, and the one of Fort Worth, Texas, they had also refused to ordain women, but these are two of the dioceses that left, at least in terms of their bishop and large number of their churches. They exited the Episcopal Church, and the liberal churches that remained went ahead and ordained women. Now, you look at this and you recognize, once again, what it means to see the conservatives leave a denomination, and the leftward drift of the Episcopal Church has absolutely no check on it whatsoever. And the kind of diversity that was trumpeted by this denomination when it changed its policy to ordain women is now out the window, as all 110 dioceses have now ordained at least one woman priest. The Church of England is being rent by a similar controversy. This time, the issue is not so much women in the priesthood as the election of women as bishops. That's taken place, of course, in the Episcopal Church, where the presiding bishop, the Right Reverend Catherine Jeffords Shorey, has been the first woman in that position for a number of years now. But in the Anglican Communion, and in the Church of England in particular, the issue of female bishops has raised the entire question of exactly whether or not there is a place for conservatives and evangelicals in that denomination. As we've seen in recent days, many of those conservatives feel that the answer is a decided no. In this week's edition, World Magazine reports that Jonathan Lopez, a student at Los Angeles City College, was required to give a speech in class. When he gave that speech, he chose to speak about Christianity, how he had seen God's actions in his own life. He referenced verses from the Bible and read the definition of marriage from a dictionary. He then declared marriage to be the union of a man and a woman. At this point, the professor in the class stopped him mid-speech. He called him names and refused to let him finish. The professor then told the class that anyone who was offended by the speech could leave. Now, no one did leave, and Mr. Lopez never received a grade on his speech. Instead, the professor wrote, quote, "Ask God what your grade is." Now, at this point, Mr. Lopez sued Los Angeles City College, suggesting that they had violated his religious liberty and equal protection rights. He also challenged the college's sexual harassment policy. He was accused of having broken it by reading the scripture and giving his Christian testimony. He charged that this is a violation of the First Amendment. A U.S. district court agreed with his argument, but just last month, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals threw out the verdict, suggesting that Mr. Lopez lacked standing because he had suffered no injury. Now, he did not receive a grade on the speech, but he did receive an A in the class. This, however, is a wake-up call to colleges and universities that when they have a professor who harasses a student and limits free speech, including religious liberty, when students are denied the equal protection of the law, they may find themselves in court. The court did determine that Mr. Lopez's speech on Christianity, God, and marriage did not violate the sexual harassment policy, regardless of whether it offended other students or professors. The professor in this class, and many of his colleagues, had better take note. Culture matters. Marriage matters. All of this should be kept in mind when you consider Patricia Cohen's article on the front page of the New York Times. It's entitled, "Culture of Poverty, Once an Academic Slur, Makes a Comeback." You have to go back into the 1960s and 70s in order to understand the setting of this story. And there, the future senator known as Daniel Patrick Moynihan released a report suggesting that the problem of black poverty in America was largely due to cultural factors. It had to do with the fact that there were so many homes without fathers, there were so many children who were raised in single-parent homes, and at the end of the day, there was no way that a society through welfare programs or even the welfare state could repair the damage left behind when this cultural damage had taken place. Now, when you look at this particular article and controversy, you recognize that no sooner had Daniel Patrick Moynihan, then an official in the administration, first of Lyndon Johnson and then of Richard Nixon, no sooner had Mr. Moynihan made his arguments than an avalanche of opposition followed. He was accused of, quote, blaming the victim, end quote, and it became politically incorrect to even concede the validity of Mr. Moynihan's arguments. Of course, time has proved him absolutely right. And now the New York Times comes back in a front page story to suggest that it is no longer professional or academic suicide to speak of the culture of poverty. The language itself is actually back, and so is the recognition that social issues really do matter, that marriage really does matter, that the intactness or lack of intactness of a family really does matter. Here's a basic sociological fact you should keep in mind. If a family is made up of a married husband and wife, both of whom have graduated from high school, neither of whom gets arrested, they are not likely to be below the poverty line. Those factors alone are sufficient to explain why they should exceed poverty and escape that trap. If, however, you take any one of those factors and add it back into the mix, the picture looks very different, and there is no way that any social program or social programs can repair that damage. Culture does matter. The culture of poverty is important. Marriage does matter. And it's a reassuring thing to understand that even the New York Times comes back to say it's no longer political or academic suicide to acknowledge this. Writing in Thursday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, Guy Sorman speaks of France's perpetual revolution. Now, what he's talking about here are the demonstrations that have been going on this week in the streets of Paris. Labor unions and college students, even high school students and others, have taken to the streets. They are protesting the actions of French President Nicolas Sarkozy to cut down on excess spending and to bring France's budget in line with its income. Now, this has happened again and again. And now Mr. Sormann goes back to the French Revolution, and especially to the putative revolution of 1848, in order to demonstrate that the French just do this over and over again. They do so, however, to very little political effect, because what they see these demonstrations as achieving is great momentum and movement towards socialism. But France can't afford socialism, and the French governments have successfully backed off the socialist experiment. And now the labor unions and the students, going all the way back to their pattern of 1848, are in the streets again. It's interesting to note how the revolutionary fervor of France was so different than the ordered revolution that was experienced both in the history of Great Britain and later in the history of the United States. France's idea of a nearly perpetual revolution has its people on the streets again, but no closer to that originating ideal. The original French Revolution was incredibly secular and, of course, permanently violent. It gave way, of course, not to an experiment in ordered liberty, but to the tyranny and despotism of Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, as these demonstrators are in the streets of Paris, it'll be fascinating to see that they'll get a great deal of media attention, but actually very little traction in the government, because the government actually has to pay the bills. It has forced options, and denying the obvious is not one of them. Some of us are old enough to remember that slogan from the 1960s that love means never having to say, you're sorry. Now, Elizabeth Bernstein, writing in the Wall Street Journal, suggests that evidently some people have bought into the argument. A major study of apologies, of the actual practice of saying, I'm sorry, well, it found that people find it more difficult to apologize to those they love than to total strangers. According to this research, the average person apologizes several times a week, but mostly to strangers or to those at some remote knowledge, but not very often to family members. We apologize to friends far more often than to those we live with as our own friends and relatives. Ms. Bernstein writes, why is it so hard to say I'm sorry to someone we love? Part of it, she suggests, is a mismatch between the ways that men and women, more specifically husbands and wives, apologize and hear and receive apologies. There are identified in this report several different forms of apology. There's the heartfelt apology, there's the strategic apology, the defensive apology, the contingent apology, and the too late apology. The heartfelt apology is sincere. We understand that. The strategic apology is necessary in order to make a relationship work. The defensive apology is one that obviously puts the one who's apologizing in the position of actually appearing as the aggrieved party. The contingent apology is one we increasingly recognize from public life and politics. This is when someone says, if I have offended you, then I apologize. The too late apology is pretty easy to understand. It's one that arrives far too late to be meaningful. Now, when you look at this report, it is clear that apology may just be more complicated than most of us take at face value. This particular article offers some good advice. If you do need to apologize and you're not sure what you need to apologize for, ask. Oh, that's something that husbands find somewhat difficult to do. If you're going to apologize, show real remorse. Don't say, I'm sorry you were hurt, which insinuates that the person had no real reason to be hurt in the first place. And don't be defensive. Don't apologize and then say but or and. Just apologize. She also suggests trying a little humor. At the very end, she suggests that if you're not sure you can offer a perfect apology, then offer an imperfect one, because an imperfect apology is far superior to no apology at all. Well, with apologies to you, I thought that you would find this interesting because, after all, apology is very much a part of our lives, and if we really mean what we say, we need to make sure we're apologizing in a way that actually apologizes. I do miss William Safire's columns in the On Language section of the New York Times Magazine. But the column continues, now written by Ben Zimmer. In this week's issue of the New York Times Magazine, he writes of the fifth anniversary of a newly coined word. The word is almost perfect as a description of our times. As a matter of fact, this particular word has become almost indispensable. It's found its way after 5 years into official dictionaries. The word was coined by Stephen Colbert, and the word is truthiness. He used it on his program on October the 17th, 2005, for the first time, and he used it in such a way that he insinuated that there was something between truth and truthfulness and untruth. Truthiness is an almost perfect word to describe, well, satirically but profoundly, the way that many people seem to get close to truth, at truth, somewhere in the neighborhood or vicinity of truth, but never actually achieving truth. The word has become so indispensable given our postmodern confusion over truth that it has not only crept its way into common parlance but into official dictionaries. 5 years later, truthiness signifies ersatz truth, something kind of close to truth, sort of artificially close to, maybe even resembling truth. Truth that is seen through a lens that isn't about being true or false, but truth-like, truth-close, truth-light. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me." Jesus told his disciples, "The truth shall set you free." That's truth, not truthiness. Christ's people are called to be the people of the truth, not the people of the lie, and certainly not the people of truthiness. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to www.sbts.edu. Let me remind you of the W Conference coming up next month on the campus of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. It's known as the W Conference because it's about connecting women with the Word. The featured speaker is our own Mary Cassian. Providing music will be Heather Payne, who for many years was with the group Point of Grace. It's going to be a very special gathering for women on this campus, held November 19th through 20th of 2010. For more information, go to sbts.edu. I'll meet you on Monday for The Briefing.